for Nezrin, who had been called away on captain duty. Aelin had left another gift, an arrow of solid gold, presented to her last Yulmas as a blessing of Diana, her own ancestor. Aelin figured the sharpshooter would love and appreciate that arrow more than she ever would have anyway.
"Do you need anything else? More food?"
Dorian asked, coming to stand beside her. Rowan, Adian, and Lysandra were already mounting their horses. They packed light, taking only the barest supplies. Mostly weapons, including Damaris, which Kaol had given to Adian, insisting the ancient blade remain on these shores. The rest of their belongings would be shipped to Terrasen. "With this group," Aelin said to Dorian, "it'll probably be a daily competition to see who can hunt the best." Dorian chuckled. Silence fell, and Aelin clicked her tongue. "You're wearing the same tunic you had on a few days ago. I don't think I ever saw you wear the same thing twice." A flicker in those sapphire eyes.
"I think I have bigger things to worry about now."
Will you be all right?"
"Do I have any option but to be?"
She touched his arm. "If you need anything, send word. It'll be a few weeks before we reach Orinth, but I suppose with magic returned, you can find a messenger to get word to me quickly."
"Thanks to you, and to your friends."
She glanced over her shoulder at them. They were all trying their best to look like they weren't eavesdropping. "Thanks to all of us," she said quietly. "And to you." Dorian gazed toward the city horizon, the rolling green foothills beyond.
"If you had asked me 9 months ago if I thought..."
He shook his head.
"So much has changed."
"And will keep changing," she said, squeezing his arm once. "But there are things that won't change. I will always be your friend." His throat bobbed.
"I wish I could see her. Just one last time. To tell her. To say what was in my heart."
"She knows," Aelin said, blinking against the burning in her eyes.
"I'll miss you," Dorian said. "Though I doubt the next time we meet will be in such civilized circumstances."
She tried not to think about it. He gestured over her shoulder to her court.
"Don't make them too miserable. They're only trying to help you."
She smiled. To her surprise, a king smiled back. "Send me any good books that you read," she said.
"Only if you do the same."
She embraced him one last time. "Thank you for everything," she whispered. Dorian squeezed her, and then stepped away as Aelin mounted her horse and nudged it into a walk. She moved to the head of the company, where Rowan rode a sleek black stallion. The Fey Prince caught her eye.
"Are you all right?"
She nodded. "I didn't think saying goodbye would be so hard, and with everything that's to come."
"We'll face it together, to whatever end."
She reached across the space between them and took his hand, gripping it tightly. They held on to each other as they rode down the barren path, through the gateway she'd made in the glass wall, and into the city streets, where people paused what they were doing and gaped or whispered or stared. But as they rode out of Rifthold, that city that had been her home and her hell and her salvation, as she memorized each street and building and face and shop, each smell and the coolness of the river breeze, she didn't see one slave, didn't hear one whip. And as they passed by the domed royal theater, there was music, beautiful, exquisite music, playing within. Dorian didn't know what awoke him. Perhaps it was that the lazy summer insects had stopped their nighttime buzzing. Or perhaps it was the chilled wind that slithered into his old tower room, ruffling the curtains. The moonlight gleaming on the clock revealed it was 3 in the morning. The city was silent. He rose from the bed, touching his neck yet again, just to make sure. Whenever he woke from his nightmares, it took him minutes to tell if he was indeed awake, or if it was merely a dream, and he was still trapped in his own body, enslaved to his father and that Vogue prince. He had not told Aelin or Kaol about the nightmares. Part of him wished he had. He could still barely remember what had happened while he'd worn that collar. He'd turned 20 and had no recollection of it. There were only bits and pieces, glimpses of horror and pain. He tried not to think about it, didn't want to remember. He hadn't told Kaol or Aelin that, either. He already missed her, and the chaos and intensity of her court. He missed having anyone around at all. The castle was too big, too quiet, and Kaol was to leave in 2 days. He didn't want to think about what missing his friend would be like. Dorian padded onto his balcony, needing to feel the river breeze on his face, to know that this was real, and he was free. He opened the balcony doors, the stones cool on his feet, and gazed out at the raised grounds. He'd done that. He loosed a breath, taking in the glass wall as it sparkled in the moonlight. There was a massive shadow perched atop it. Dorian froze. Not a shadow, but a giant beast, its claws gripping the wall, its wings tucked into its body, shimmering faintly in the glow of the full moon. Shimmering, like the white hair of the rider atop it. Even from the distance, he knew she was staring right at him, her hair streaming to the side like a ribbon of moonlight, caught in the river breeze. Dorian lifted a hand, the other rising to his neck. No collar. The rider on the wyvern leaned down in her saddle, saying something to her beast. It spread its massive glimmering wings and leaped into the air. Each beat of its wings sent a hollowed-out booming gust of wind toward him. It flapped higher, her hair streaming behind her like a glittering banner, until they vanished into the night, and he couldn't hear its wings beating anymore. No one sounded the alarm, as if the world had stopped paying attention for the few moments they'd looked at each other. And through the darkness of his memories, through the pain and despair and terror he'd tried to forget, a name echoed in his head. Manon Blackbeak sailed into the starry night sky, Abraxos warm and swift under her, the blazingly bright moon, the mother's full womb, above her. She didn't know why she'd bothered to go, why she'd been curious. But there had been the prince, no collar to be seen around his neck. And he had lifted his hand in greeting, as if to say, "I remember you." The winds shifted, and Abraxos rode them, rising higher into the sky, the darkened kingdom below passing by in a blur. Changing winds. A changing world. Perhaps a changing 13, too. And herself. She didn't know what to make of it. But Manon hoped they'd all survive it. She hoped. Chapter 89. For 3 weeks they rode straight north, keeping off the main roads and out of the villages. There was no need to announce that Aelin was on her way back to Terrasen. Not until she saw her kingdom for herself, and knew what she faced, both from within and from what gathered down in Morath. Not until she had somewhere safe to hide the great, terrible thing in her saddlebag. With her magic, no one noticed the Wordkey's presence. But Rowan would occasionally glance at the saddlebag and angle his head in inquiry. Each time, she'd silently tell him she was fine, and that she hadn't noticed anything strange regarding the amulet, or regarding the Eye of Elaena, which she again wore at her throat. She wondered if Lorcan was indeed on his way to hunt down the second and third keys, perhaps where Parrington, Erewhon, had held them all along, if the king hadn't been lying. She had a feeling Lorcan would start looking in Morath, and prayed the Fey warrior would defy the odds stacked against him and emerge triumphant. It would certainly make her life easier, even if he'd one day come to kick her ass for deceiving him. The summer days grew cooler the farther north they rode. Evangeline, to her credit, kept pace with them, never complaining about having to sleep on a bedroll night after night. She seemed perfectly happy to curl up with Fleetfoot, her new protector and loyal friend. Lysandra used the journey to test out her abilities, sometimes flying with Rowan overhead, sometimes running as a pretty black dog alongside Fleetfoot, sometimes spending days in her ghost leopard form and pouncing on Adian whenever he least expected it. 3 weeks of grueling travel, but also 3 of the happiest weeks Aelin had ever experienced. She would have preferred a little more privacy, especially with Rowan, who kept looking at her in that way that made her want to combust. Sometimes, when no one was watching, he'd sneak up behind her and nuzzle her neck, or tug at her earlobe with his teeth, or just slide his arms around her and hold her against him, breathing her in. One night, just one god's damned night with him was all she wanted. They didn't dare stop at an inn, so she was left to burn, and to endure Lysandra's quiet teasing. The terrain grew steeper, hillier, and the world turned lush and green and bright, the rocks becoming jagged granite outcroppings. The sun had barely risen, as Aelin walked beside her horse, sparing it from having to carry her up a particularly steep hill. She was already on her second meal of the day, already sweaty and dirty and cranky. Fire magic, it turned out, came in rather handy while traveling, keeping them warm on the chill nights, lighting their fires and boiling their water. She would have killed for a tub big enough to fill with water and bathe in, but luxuries could wait.
"It's just up this hill," Adian said from her left.
"What is?" she asked, finishing her apple and chucking the remains behind her. Lysandra, wearing the form of a crow, squawked in outrage as the core hit her. "Sorry," Aelin called. Lysandra cawed and soared skyward, Fleetfoot barking merrily at her, as Evangeline giggled from atop her shaggy pony. Adian pointed to the hill crest ahead.
"You'll see."
Aelin looked at Rowan, who had been scouting ahead for part of the morning as a white-tailed hawk. Now he walked beside her, guiding his black stallion along. He lifted his brows at her silent demand for information.
"I'm not going to tell you."
She glowered at him. "Buzzard." Rowan grinned, but with every step, Aelin did the calculations about what day it was, and they crested the hill and halted. Aelin released the reins and took a staggering step, the emerald grass soft underfoot. Adian touched her shoulder.
"Welcome home, Aelin."
A land of towering mountains, the staghorns spread before them, with valleys and rivers and hills, a land of untamed wild beauty. Terrasen. And the smell of pine and snow. How had she never realized that Rowan's scent was of Terrasen, of home? Rowan came close enough to graze her shoulder and murmured,
"I feel as if I've been looking for this place my entire life."
Indeed, with the wicked wind flowing fast and strong between the gray jagged staghorns in the distance, with a dense spread of oakwald to their left, and the rivers and valleys sprawling toward those great northern mountains, it was paradise for a hawk, paradise for her.
"Right there," Adian said,
pointing to a small weather-worn granite boulder carved with whorls and swirls.
"Once we pass that rock, we're on Terrasen soil."
Not quite daring to believe she wasn't still asleep, Aelin walked toward that rock, whispering the song of thanks to Mala Firebringer for leading her to this place, this moment. Aelin ran a hand over the rough rock, and the sun-warmed stone tingled as if in greeting. Then she stepped beyond the stone. And at long last, Aelin Ashriver Galathinius was home.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Empire of Storms, Book 5 in the Throne of Glass series free.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Queen of Shadows. Written by Sarah J. Mass. Performed by Elizabeth Evans. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2015 by Sarah J. Mass. Production copyright 2015 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
And now a free preview of Empire of Storms, Book 5 in the Throne of Glass series.
Nightfall. The bone drums had been pounding across the jagged slopes of the Black Mountains since sundown. From the rocky outcropping on which her war tent groaned against the dry wind, Princess Elena Galathinius had been monitoring the Dreadlord's army all afternoon, as it washed across those mountains in ebony waves. And now that the sun had long since vanished, the enemy campfires flickered across the mountains and valley below like a blanket of stars. So many fires. So many, compared to those burning on her side of the valley. She did not need the gift of her fey ears to hear the prayers of her human army, both spoken and silent. She'd offered up several herself in the past few hours, though she knew they would go unanswered. Elena had never considered where she might die, never considered that it might be so far from the rocky green of Terrasen, that her body might not be burned, but devoured by the Dreadlord's beasts. There would be no marker to tell the world where a princess of Terrasen had fallen. There would be no marker for any of them.
"You need rest,"
a rough male voice said from the tent entrance behind her. Elena looked over her shoulder, her unbound silver hair snagging on the intricate leather scales of her armor. But Gavin's dark gaze was already on the two armies stretching below them, on that narrow black band of demarcation, too soon to be breached. For all his talk of rest, Gavin hadn't removed his own armor upon entering their tent hours before. Only minutes ago had his war leaders finally shoved out of the tent, bearing maps in their hands and not a shred of hope in their hearts. She could scent it on them. The fear. The despair. Gavin's steps hardly crunched on the dry, rocky earth as he approached her lonely vigil, near silent thanks to his years roaming the wilds of the south. Elena again faced those countless enemy fires. He said hoarsely,
"Your father's forces could still make it."
A fool's hope. Her immortal hearing had picked up every word of the hours of debate raging inside the tent behind them. "This valley is now a death trap," Elena said. And she had led them all here. Gavin did not answer.
"Come dawn," Elena went on. "It will be bathed in blood."
The war leader at her side remained silent. So rare for Gavin, that silence. Not a flicker of that untamed fierceness shone in his up-tilted eyes, and his shaggy brown hair hung limp. She couldn't remember the last time either of them had bathed. Gavin turned to her with that frank assessment that had stripped her bare from the moment she'd first met him, in her father's hall nearly a year ago. Lifetimes ago. Such a different time. A different world, when the lands had still been full of singing and light, when magic hadn't begun to flicker in the growing shadow of Erewhon and his demon soldiers. She wondered how long Orinth would hold out once the slaughter here in the south had ended. Wondered if Erewhon would first destroy her father's shining palace atop the mountain, or if he would burn the royal library, burn the heart and knowledge of an age, and then burn its people.
"Dawn is yet hours away," said Gavin,
his throat bobbing.
"Time enough for you to make a run for it."
"They'd tear us to shreds before we could clear the passes."
"Not us. You."
The firelight cast his tan face in flickering relief.
"You alone."
"I will not abandon these people." Her fingers grazed his.
"Or you."
Gavin's face didn't stir.
"There is no avoiding tomorrow. Or the bloodshed. You overheard what the messenger said. I know you did. Aniel is a slaughterhouse. Our allies from the north are gone. Your father's army is too far behind. We will all die before the sun is fully risen."
"We'll all die one day anyway,"
No.
Gavin squeezed her hand.
I will die. Those people down there, they will die, either by sword or time. But you?
His gaze flicked to her delicately pointed ears, the heritage of her father.
You could live for centuries. Millennia. Do not throw it away for a doomed battle.
I would sooner die tomorrow than live for a thousand years with a coward's shame. But Gavin stared across the valley again. At his people, the last line of defense against Erewhon's horde.
Get behind your father's lines, he said roughly, and continue the fight from there.
She swallowed hard.
It would be no use.
Slowly, Gavin looked at her. And after all these months, all this time, she confessed, my father's power is failing. He is close, decades now, from the fading. Mala's light dims inside him with every passing day. He cannot stand against Erewhon and win. Her father's last words before she'd set out on this doomed quest months ago.
My sun is setting, Elena. You must find a way to ensure yours still rises.
Gavin's face leached of color.
You choose now to tell me this?
I choose now, Gavin, because there is no hope for me either. Whether I flee tonight or fight tomorrow, the continent will fall. Gavin shifted toward the dozen tents on the outcropping. His friends. Her friends.
None of us are walking away tomorrow, he said.
And it was the way his words broke, the way his eyes shone, that had her reaching for his hand once more. Never, not once in all their adventures, in all the horrors that they had endured together, had she seen him cry.
Erewhon will win and rule this land, and all others, for eternity,
Gavin whispered. Soldiers stirred in their camp below, men and women, murmuring, swearing, weeping. Elena tracked the source of their terror, all the way across the valley. One by one, as if a great hand of darkness wiped them away, the fires of the Dreadlord's camp went out. The bone drums beat louder. He had arrived at last. Erewhon himself had come to oversee the final stand of Gavin's army.
They are not going to wait until dawn, Gavin said,
a hand lurching to where Damaris was sheathed at his side. But Elena gripped his arm, the hard muscle like granite beneath his leather armor. Erewhon had come. Perhaps the gods were still listening. Perhaps her mother's fiery soul had convinced them. She took in Gavin's harsh, wild face, the face that she had come to cherish above all others, and she said,
we are not going to win this battle.
And we are not going to win this war. His body quivered with the restraint to keep from going to his war leaders, but he gave her the respect of listening. They'd both given each other that, had learned it the hard way. With her free hand, Elena lifted her fingers in the air between them. The raw magic in her veins now danced, from flame to water to curling vine to cracking ice. Not an endless abyss like her father's, but a versatile, nimble gift of magic, granted by her mother.
We are not going to win this war, Elena repeated,
Gavin's face aglow in the light of her uncut power.
But we can delay it a little while. I can get across that valley in an hour or two.
She curled her fingers into a fist and snuffed out her magic. Gavin's brows furrowed.
What you speak of is madness, Elena. Suicide. His lieutenants will catch you before you can even slip through the lines.
Exactly. They'll bring me right to him, now that he has come. They'll consider me his prized prisoner, not his assassin.
No.
An order and a plea. Kill Erewhon, and his beasts will panic. Long enough for my father's forces to arrive, unite with whatever remains of ours, and crush the enemy legions.
You say kill Erewhon as if that is some easy task. He is a Volg king, Elena. Even if they bring you to him, he will leash you to his will before you can make a move.
Her heart strained, but she forced the words out. That is why... She couldn't stop her wobbling lips. That is why I need you to come with me, instead of fight with your men.
Gavin only stared at her.
Because I need...
Tears slid down her cheeks.
I need you as a distraction. I need you to buy me time to get past his inner defenses.
Just as the battle tomorrow would buy them time.
Because Erewhon would go for Gavin first, the human warrior who had been a bastion against the Dark Lord's forces for so long, who had fought him when no other would. Erewhon's hatred for the human prince was rivaled only by his hatred for her father. Gavin studied her for a long moment, then reached to brush her tears away.
He cannot be killed, Elena. You heard what your father's oracle whispered.
She nodded.
I know.
And even if we manage to contain him, trap him.
Gavin considered her words.
You know that we are only pushing the war onto someone else. To whoever one day rules these lands.
This war, she said quietly, is but the second movement in a game that has been played since those ancient days across the sea.
We put it off for someone else to inherit if he's freed. And it will not save those soldiers down there from slaughter tomorrow.
If we do not act, there won't be anyone to inherit this war, Elena said.
Doubt danced in Gavin's eyes.
Even now, she pushed, our magic is failing, our gods abandoning us, running from us. We have no Fey allies beyond those in my father's army, and their power, like his, is fading. But perhaps, when that third movement comes, perhaps the players in our unfinished game will be different. Perhaps it will be a future in which Fey and humans fight side by side, ripe with power. Maybe they will find a way to end this. So we will lose this battle, Gavin, she said. Our friends will die on that killing field come dawn, and we will use it as our distraction to contain Erewhon, so that Irelia might have a future.
His lips tightened, his sapphire eyes wide.
No one must know, she said,
her voice breaking.
Even if we succeed, no one must know what we do.
Doubt etched deep lines into his face. She gripped his hand harder.
No one, Gavin.
Agony rippled across his features. But he nodded. Hand in hand, they stared toward the darkness coating the mountains, the Dreadlord's bone drums pounding like hammers on iron. Too soon, those drums would be drowned out by the screams of dying soldiers. Too soon, the valley fields would be carved with streams of blood. Gavin said,
If we are to do this, we need to leave now.
His attention again snagged on the nearby tents. No goodbyes. No last words.
I'll give Holdren the order to lead tomorrow. He'll know what to tell the others.
She nodded, and it was confirmation enough. Gavin released her hand, striding for the tent closest to their own, to where his dearest friend and most loyal war leader was likely making the best of his final hours with his new wife. Elena drew her eyes away, before Gavin's broad shoulders pushed through the heavy flaps. She gazed over the fires, across the valley, to the darkness perched on the other side. She could have sworn it stared back, sworn she heard the thousand whetstones as the dread lord's beasts sharpened their poison-slick claws. She lifted her eyes toward the smoke-stained sky, the plumes parting for a heartbeat, to reveal a star-flecked night. The Lord of the North flickered down at her. Perhaps the final gift of Mala to these lands, in this age, at least. Perhaps a thank you to Elena herself, and a farewell. Because for Terrison, for Irelia, Elena would walk into the eternal darkness lurking across the valley to buy them all a chance. Elena sent up a final prayer on a pillar of smoke rising from the valley floor, that the unborn faraway scions of this night, heirs to a burden that would doom or save Irelia, would forgive her for what she was about to do. Part 1. The Fire Bringer. Chapter 1. Elide Locken's breath scorched her throat with every gasping inhale as she limped up the steep forest hill. Beneath the soggy leaves coating Oakwald's floor, loose gray stones made the slope treacherous, the towering oak stretching too high above for her to grip any branches should she tumble down. Braving the potential fall in favor of speed, Elide scrambled over the lip of the craggy summit, her leg twanging with pain as she slumped to her knees. Forested hills rolled away in every direction, the trees like the bars of a never-ending cage. Weeks. It had been weeks since Manon Blackbeak and the 13 had left her in this forest, the wingleader ordering her to head north, to find her lost queen, now grown and mighty, and to also find Selena Sardothian, whoever she was, so that Elide might repay the life debt she owed to Caltaine Rompier. Even weeks later, her dreams were plagued by those final moments in Morath, the guards who had tried to drag her to be implanted with Volg offspring, the wingleader's complete massacre of them, and Caltaine Rompier's final act, carving the strange dark stone from where it had been sewn into her arm, and ordering Elide to take it to Selena Sardothian, right before Caltaine turned Morath into a smoldering ruin. Elide put a dirty, near-trembling hand to the hard lump tucked in the breast pocket of the flying leathers she still wore. She could have sworn a faint throbbing echoed into her skin, a counterbeat to her own racing heart. Elide shuddered in the watery sunlight trickling through the green canopy. Summer lay heavy over the world, the heat now oppressive enough that water had become her most precious commodity. It had been from the start, but now her entire day, her life, revolved around it. Fortunately, Oakwald was rife with streams after the last of the melted mountain snows had snaked from their peaks. Unfortunately, Elide had learned the hard way about what water to drink. 3 days she'd been near death with vomiting and fever after gulping down that stagnant pond water. 3 days she'd shivered so badly she thought her bones would crack apart. 3 days, quietly weeping in pitiful despair that she'd die here, alone in this endless forest, and no one would ever know. And through it all, that stone in her breast pocket thrummed and throbbed. In her fevered dreams, she could have sworn it whispered to her, sang lullabies in languages that she did not think human tongues could utter. She hadn't heard it since, but she still wondered. Wondered if most humans would have died. Wondered whether she carried a gift or a curse northward, and if this Selena Sardothian would know what to do with it.
"Tell her that you can open any door if you have the key,"
Caltaine had said. Elide often studied the iridescent black stone whenever she halted for a needed break. It certainly didn't look like a key, rough-hewn, as if it had been cleaved from a larger chunk of stone. Perhaps Caltaine's words were a riddle meant only for its recipient. Elite unslung her two-light pack from her shoulders and yanked open the canvas flap. She'd run out of food a week ago and had taken to scavenging for berries. They were all foreign, but a whisper of a memory from her years with her nursemaid Finula had warned her to rub them on her wrist first, to see if they raised any reaction. Most of the time, too much of the time, they did. But every now and then she'd stumble across a bush sagging with the right ones, and she'd gorge herself before filling her pack. Fishing inside the pink and blue stained canvas interior, Elite dug out the last handful, wrapped in her spare shirt, the white fabric now a splotchy red and purple. One handful, to last until she found her next meal. Hunger gnawed at her, but Elite ate only half. Maybe she'd find more before she stopped for the night. She didn't know how to hunt, and the thought of catching another living thing, of snapping its neck or bashing in its skull with a rock, she was not yet that desperate. Perhaps it made her not a blackbeak after all, despite her mother's hidden bloodline. Elite licked her fingers clean of the berry juice, dirt and all, and hissed as she stood on stiff, sore legs. She wouldn't last long without food, but couldn't risk venturing into a village with the money Manon had given her, or toward any of the hunters' fires she'd spotted these past few weeks. No. She had seen enough of the kindness and mercy of men. She would never forget how those guards had leered at her naked body, why her uncle had sold her to Duke Parrington. Wincing, Elite swung her pack over her shoulders and carefully set off down the hill's far slope, picking her way among the rocks and roots. Maybe she'd made a wrong turn. How would she know when she'd crossed Terrison's border anyway? And how would she ever find her queen, her court? Elite shoved the thoughts away, keeping to the murky shadows and avoiding the splotches of sunlight. It'd only make her thirstier, hotter. Find water, perhaps more important than finding berries, before darkness set in. She reached the foot of the hill, suppressing a groan at the labyrinth of wood and stone. It seemed she now stood in a dried stream bed wending between the hills. It curved sharply ahead, northward. A sigh rattled out of her. Thank Aneth. At least the Lady of Wise Things had not abandoned her yet. She'd follow the stream bed for as long as possible, staying northward, and then... Elite didn't know what sense exactly picked up on it. Not smell, or sight, or sound, for nothing beyond the rot of the loam, and the sunlight, and the stones, and the whispering of the high above leaves was out of the ordinary, but... there. Like some thread in a great tapestry had snagged, her body locked up. The humming and rustling of the forest went quiet a heartbeat later. Elite scanned the hills, the stream bed. The roots of an oak atop the nearest hill jutted from the slope's grassy side, providing a thatch of wood and moss over the dead stream. Perfect. She limped for it, ruined leg barking, stones clattering and wrenching at her ankles. She could nearly touch the tips of the roots when the first hollowed-out boom echoed. Not thunder. No. She would never forget this one particular sound, for it too haunted her dreams, both awake and asleep. The beating of mighty leathery wings. Wyverns. And perhaps more deadly, the iron-teeth witches who rode them, senses as sharp and fine-tuned as their mounts. Elite lunged for the overhang of thick roots as the wing beats neared, the forest silent as a graveyard. Stones and sticks ripped at her bare hands, her knees banging on the rocky dirt as she pressed herself into the hillside and peered at the canopy through the latticework of roots. One beat, then another, not even a heartbeat after, synced enough that anyone in the forest might think it was only an echo. But Elite knew. two witches. She'd picked up enough in her time in Morath to know the Iron Teeth were under orders to keep their numbers hidden. They'd fly in perfect mirrored formation, so listening ears might only report one wyvern. But these two, whoever they were sloppy. Or as sloppy as one of the immortal lethal witches could be. Lower-level coven members, perhaps, out on a scouting mission.
Or hunting for someone,
a small petrified voice whispered in her head. Aleed pressed harder into the soil, roots digging into her back as she monitored the canopy. And there, the blur of a swift-moving, massive shape gliding right above the canopy, rattling the leaves. A leathery, membranous wing, its edge tipped in a curved, poison-slick talon, flashed in the sunlight. Rarely, so rarely were they ever out in daylight. Whatever they hunted, it had to be important. Aleed didn't dare breathe too loudly until those wing beats faded, sailing due north. Toward the Farian Gap, where Manon had mentioned the second half of the host was camped. Aleed only moved when the forest's buzzing and chittering resumed. Staying still for so long had caused her muscles to cramp, and she groaned as she stretched out her legs, then her arms, then rolled her shoulders. Endless. This journey was endless. She'd give anything for a safe roof over her head, and a hot meal. Maybe seeking them out, if only for a night, was worth the risk. Picking her way along the bone-dry stream bed, Aleed made it two steps before that sense that was not a sense twanged again, as if a warm female hand had gripped her shoulder to stop. The tangled wood murmured with life. But she could feel it. Feel something out there. Not witches or wyverns or beasts, but someone. Someone was watching her. Someone was following her. Aleed casually unsheathed the fighting knife Manon had given her upon leaving this miserable forest. She wished the witch had taught her how to kill. Lorcan Salvatore had been running from those god's damned beasts for 2 days now. He didn't blame them. The witches had been pissed when he'd snuck into their forest camp in the dead of night, slaughtered three of their sentinels without them or their mounts noticing, and dragged a fourth into the trees for questioning. It had taken him 2 hours to get the Yellowlegs witch to break, hidden so deep down the throat of a cave that even her screams had been contained. 2 hours, and then she was singing for him. Twin witch armies now stood poised to take the continent, one in Morath, one in the Farian Gap. The Yellowlegs knew nothing of what power Duke Parrington wielded, knew nothing of what Lorcan hunted. The other two word keys, the siblings to the one he wore on a long chain around his neck. 3 slivers of stone cleaved from an unholy word gate, each key capable of tremendous and terrible power. And when all 3 word keys were united, they could open that gate between worlds, destroy those worlds, or summon their armies, and far, far worse.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview of Empire of Storms, Book 5 in the Throne of Glass series. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.